Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 28, 2017. This talk and Sangha discussion is on the Ratana Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Ratana Sutta, has everybody heard the term the three jewels or the three refuges or the triple refuge? But not everyone. The reason why, it's a rather common term in Buddhism, and certainly in modern Buddhism. There's even Buddhist religions that have taken on the name in one form or another. One worldwide organization is called Triratna. I almost want to comment on that, but I won't. there's some difficulties in that particular organization, and it's interesting that they've chosen this particular name, because what the name refers to is seeing these three refuges exactly as that word implies, that they're true refuges. So let me read the sutta. And there's no way of knowing if this is the first time the Buddha referred to these three refuges in this manner, but I haven't come across it anywhere else directly. So it's interesting in that way, and you'll understand all that if I ever get to reading this. So, nearly all schools of Buddhism refer to the triple refuge, or taking refuge in the three jewels. So refuge is a place or a state of mind that is a protection or shelter from hardship or danger. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a source of comfort and peace. True refuge is found, in this instance, first in the Buddha, and then in the Dhamma, his teachings, and finally in a well-focused Sangha. In Buddhism, when one takes refuge, one is taking refuge in these precious jewels. The ritual of taking refuge is often a formal and usually public statement of holding the strong intention to have the example of the Buddha and the teachings of the Dhamma be the framework for one's own awakening, along with supporting and receiving the support of a community of Dhamma practitioners or the Sangha. So, quite a few years ago now, as part of my moving towards taking formal vows as a monk, which I never did, there was a weekend ceremony of taking refuge, and it was in the Tibetan lineage, and it was quite elaborate and beautiful and interesting. And eventually I did take these vows of refuge. I've obviously left that particular Tibetan order. But that's usually how it's presented, but it's not necessarily the only way that one can formally take refuge. In fact, we take true refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha every time we have a class here and on our retreats, because of the way that the Buddha's teachings and his actual lineage have been maintained through the years and right here tonight. The teaching known as the Jewel Discourse, or the Ratana Sutta, was given in the city of Visalia at a time of widespread famine and spreading disease. There were many dead bodies as the conditions overwhelmed the ability to properly dispose of bodies. The local citizens sought out the Buddha's help, who was nearby in Rajagaha. The Buddha arrived in Visalia a short time later with a large number of monks, including Ananda. Just before the Buddha's arrival, torrential rains helped the situation somewhat by cleansing the landscape of rotting corpses and cleaning the air and water. Not a pleasant sight, is it, that this most important sutta is given? The Buddha presented this teaching to an entire city overcome by physical and emotional suffering. Prior to his presenting this discourse, he instructed his attending monks to walk through the city and do what they could to ease the physical suffering of the citizens and to individually present this teaching. At the formal the importance of that, and it points to the importance of how to actually develop the Dhamma. The Dhamma was never presented as an escape from the difficulties in the world. In fact, that would contradict the first noble truth, that dukkha occurs. There's going to be difficulties simply as a consequence of having a human life. There's going to be things like widespread famine and disease, and then just simply minor individual disappointments, all part of human life. We can't avoid that if we're going to have a human life. what we can and what the sutta points to is to not stick the second arrow in, if you remember the Salatha Sutta, by reacting and taking things personally, which are completely impersonal in nature. And another important point is that we should take care of our own physical needs. This isn't an escape from even doing that. The Buddha taught that there were four things we all need. We need food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. So this isn't a way of magically not having any of those needs either. That's part of having a human life. So part of the Dhamma itself is taking care of us, taking care of ourselves, and taking care of each other. Most importantly, so that we're free to develop the Dhamma to its conclusion. In other words, don't get involved in situations and behaviors that are likely to bring sickness and disease and stress on our physical body. Do our best to maintain ourselves in a healthy manner, part of the Dhamma. And so the Buddha did that first by addressing the physical needs of the town. Then he gathered them and he taught them the Dhamma. At the formal teaching, the Buddha then presented a way to bring true refuge from the stress and suffering of the world and put an end to all self-inflicted dukkha suffering. The Buddha's words, "May all beings assembled have peace of mind. May all beings assembled listen mindfully to these words." Now think about this. The Buddha's addressing a town that has been devastated. And the first thing he's pointing to is to maintain a peaceful mind. And then he gets right to the point of how to do that. "May you all radiate goodwill and loving kindness to all who offer help and understanding to you." He's immediately getting their focus from, oh, how awful their lives are, to away from that self-referential view and expressing true dana, true generosity. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on tonight. Towards the people that are helping you. Understand this. There is no more precious jewel, no more refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. As woodland groves in the early heat of summer are crowned with blossoming flowers, so is the sublime Dhamma leading to the calm and peace of Nirvana. The peerless and excellent awakened one, the teacher of true understanding, the teacher of the noble path, is the Buddha, the one who has awakened. So here's the qualifier to that, and it's important. My words, here the Buddha is not teaching worship of himself. The Buddha often referred to himself as the Tathagata, which means the one who has gone forth. And even in a more subtle way, it means the one who figured this out first. The Buddha had gone forth from distraction and ignorance, stress and suffering, to a well-concentrated wisdom. He liberated himself from clinging to all objects and wrong views. Through his own effort, Siddhartha Gautama awakened, and he became a Buddha, which simply means an awakened one. The Buddha here is offering himself as the example of one going forth on the Eightfold Path and awakening. So he's not setting himself up as some superhuman or godlike being. He's simply in front of these people saying, look, I'm a human being just like you, and I did what I'm going to tell you to do. If I can do it, you can do it. He never, ever separated himself in any significant way except in that way to say that I'm the guy that figured this out. I'm the one who first went forth. Other than that, I'm just as human as all of you, meaning the Buddha. And if I can do it, you can do it. Taking refuge in the Buddha is understanding that all human beings can go forth from ignorance and attain wisdom and right understanding. There is great protection and comfort in understanding that liberation and freedom is possible for all human beings. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The Buddha, calm and mindful, has experienced the cessation of clinging and desire through this Dhamma that he's now teaching. The deathless state of Nirvana has been attained. Now, again, this is not, the Buddha's not teaching everlasting life. The deathless state doesn't refer to that. The deathless state, meaning that we have brought to cessation all self-referential views. Anatta has died. And so now there is nothing to hinder living a life free of those entanglements from a self-referential ego self rooted in ignorant views. Is that clear? That's the meaning of the deathless state. The Buddha is never talking about living forever. It has nothing to do with it. It's living free of the ongoing cycle of ignorant views that keep us stuck in this in always giving birth to more ignorant moments prone to suffering. We've escaped that, the deathless state. That's clear? The Buddha teaches the Noble Eightfold Path that unfailingly brings concentration, liberation, and freedom. There is no more precious jewel than this Dhamma, the second refuge. The Buddha here is describing that there is a precious jewel in taking refuge in the path of liberation and freedom. In this setting in Visali, the Buddha is teaching that one's practical needs have been taken care of, to turn one's attention to being mindful of the teachings of the Buddha, and to turn your attention to the example that he gave of awakening. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the Sangha. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The virtuous ones who bring the Dhamma, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those with steadfast minds, free of clinging, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that understand with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that gain true insight and abandon self-delusion, doubt, and indulgence in meaningless rites and rituals, they are the jewel of the Sangha. So what the Buddha is also describing there is how to engage with someone who's teaching the Dhamma, that they actually know what they're teaching. They're teaching a Dhamma that one can actually take refuge in and will have actually bear some benefit. So he's putting a fine line, or maybe he's fine-tuning our view of what constitutes the Dhamma, a teacher of the Dhamma, and a subsequent Sangha. So we can't have a Sangha that is a refuge unless the Sangha itself is rooted in the teachings that refuge is based on. Is that clear? So again, a short way of saying that is a well-focused Sangha that is well-focused on the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path, which is what we're so fortunate to have here in Frenchtown. Lost my spot. The Four Noble Truths, that is the jewel of the Sangha. So the Buddha is pointing out that the Sangha is an expression of the Four Noble Truths. It's not something seeking something different or trying to reinterpret the Buddha's teachings. The Four Noble Truths are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that gain true insight and abandon self-delusion, doubt, and indulgence in meaningless rites and rituals, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those beyond despair and evil doings, they are the jewel of the Sangha. What the Buddha is saying, that as we as a Sangha are developing this, the Dhamma, and abandoning things that in the past were unskillful and hurtful behavior, we are now becoming our own jewels in the Sangha. And from this seat, I can tell you, it's amazing the jewels that have developed in this Sangha, in Frenchtown, and I would say in all three different classes. One of the things that's interesting, there's a little bit of an overlap, but there's almost three separate Sanghas that have developed here, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Again, there's not that there's overlap. And the development of each Sangha is about the same meaning and understanding. And the concern and the real support that we are able to give each other because we've all taken the time to develop a true Dhamma is really remarkable. I've been around Buddhism for a long, long time, 37 years, something like that. And I've studied with some of the great teachers and, I've done a lot of things in different schools. And I've never seen a more well-focused Sangha than what has developed here in Frenchtown. It really is remarkable, and we're fortunate for that. Let me continue. Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, who can no longer conceal the truth from themselves due to the Sangha. What a powerful line. We can't fool ourselves anymore because we are all committed to the Dhamma. Let me read that again. Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, who can no longer conceal the truth for themselves due to that Sangha, they are the precious jewel of the Sangha. Do you see not to overemphasize it, but do you see the responsibility of actually developing the Dhamma that we have for each other? One of the things that you hear me say often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all others is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And that refers to our Sangha too. The most loving and compassionate thing we can do for each other in our Sangha is to continue to develop the Dhamma. Because again, then we are shining, we're individual jewels in this light of the Sangha. It's quite a responsibility, isn't it? The Buddha continues, those whose karma is extinguished, remember we've been talking a lot about karma and rebirth the last few weeks on Saturday, those whose karma is extinguished, the future of no concern, with rebirth ending, what rebirth there is referring to, not giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, that's also karma ending. With rebirth ending, due to the support of the Sangha. Now, I got to also put this in perspective. This is the Buddha giving this talk in that setting I described. And he first acknowledged himself as a role model, as a human being. But now he's taking this sutta and putting the whole, or almost the entire responsibility for awakening now on the Sangha. And he's speaking this to a group that prior to this was so confused and deluded because of their own suffering. And imagine what's occurring in their minds now. Those whose karma is extinguished, the future of no concern, with rebirth ending due to the support of the Sangha, this is the precious jewel of the Sangha. My words. The example of the Buddha's life, the teachings of the Buddha, meaning the Dhamma, along with the support of the Sangha, provides refuge from the suffering of distraction and ignorance arising from dukkha. Being mindful of the three jewels concentrates the mind to what is of utmost importance. Taking refuge in the three jewels and the triple refuge is taking great comfort in understanding that awakening is possible for any human being. The example of the Buddha's life shows that. There is great comfort in realizing that the way of liberation is a path accessible and integrated by anyone, the Eightfold Path. There is also great comfort in knowing that we do not engage in the path of liberation and freedom alone. The Buddha often said that the most important aspect of practice is a well-focused Sangha. He does so in the Sutta. The support and commitment that we gain from each other often provides the encouragement and strength to continue, even when difficult times interfere, and I bet you every one of us would agree with that last statement. Holding in mind the three jewels, the three refuges, provides continual direction for one's mindfulness. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha also provides a framework for mindful expression of joy and freedom. That last line means that we share our enthusiasm for our ongoing awakening. That's the end of the talk tonight. Thank you for listening. Just a kind of a quick question, and I want to ask, anybody wants an answer, but I want to ask Greg first. When you first got an inclination of what was going on here, I think you saw this as a refuge, didn't you? I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but am I correct in saying that?
I don't know if I fully am. I might see the word a little differently. Refuge sounds like an escape, just from the way that it's kind of... The way my brain processes it, and I probably have it wrong. I don't know. I don't think I have the word right in my head.
Yeah, refuge can...
I think refuge, I picture kind of like hiding from a storm or something.
Yep, it certainly can be seen that way. And you're right that if you see it that way, that's not the right way to see refuge. Refuge is a place of safety, but it certainly isn't an escape from the world. In fact, it's a way of escaping from wrong views of the world. And eventually and ultimately, to be fully immersed in the world without being distracted by the natural suffering in the world. So it is a true refuge in that way.
But I absolutely saw it immediately, you know, upon entering, as a place of peace, and that there was some real, you know, obvious, some real wisdom going on in here, floating around.
And peace and Sangha. A lot of people that first come into this room will remark that way. It just has a feeling to it. And there is, and I don't want to get into woo-woo and mystical stuff, but there is a presence that takes place because of a well-focused Sangha. And we all feel that, I think. Anybody else want to comment on that, what I just asked Greg directly, but I would just put him on the spot, Nash?
Well, in the very first class that I came to, you mentioned taking refuge in three jewels, and it's been, that was like a huge help like right from the beginning, because I didn't feel like peace and comfort like being in here, just even after the first time, and just of how like simple and consistent the Dhamma is.
Yeah.
I've really been able, like, it's just natural to be able to like take comfort in it, because almost every class, things that we've talked about every single class up to this one will come up, because it's just all so consistent and like cohesive. And the fact that, you know, there was someone who was able to do this and teach it, and the teaching is still here all those years later, is, you know, it's just natural to take comfort in that. And then, you know, being in a room full of people who are, you know, generally feel the same way is really special.
Yeah.
And I have felt that since the first day, and that's why I'm here today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that. It really is remarkable that these teachings that were given 2,600 years ago are still here today, in their pure form. I mean, that, and I won't get into that talk. It's in the book too. But it's remarkable how it's been preserved. And the Buddha's Dhamma comes across that way, doesn't it? Very gentle, and it's caring, and it's accessible, and it is consistent. Now, there's aspects that sometimes sound confusing, but that's only because we're not getting it in the proper context yet. You know, but that's what it is. The greatest thinker also happened to be the most compassionate human being that ever walked this planet, I think, you know, my opinion, obviously. But it's because of his teachings, and that those teachings are still relevant. And again, there's a responsibility to that, to taking true refuge, and that is in preserving the second jewel, the Dhamma. And I think that's done pretty well here, too. So, Isabel.
Yeah, I would have to say that I have definitely taken refuge within this space, especially when it comes to the idea of developing the Dhamma, because it is a safe space in the sense of, it's, for me personally, it's, I am confronted with these events and these things that happen, where then I can fall back onto these things, the Buddha, Dhamma, and myself, and the Sangha.
Yeah.
So it is a space of refuge, very much so, and I'm just very grateful for that.
Thank you. What a great description of how a practical application of refuge. When stuff happens, we got something to fall back on, so thank you. Well, let's go around the room and see what's going on. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you.
How's your practice? What do you think?
Practice is fairly consistent. You know, the sits are daily, but you know, the studying and reading the Dhamma has been a little bit lax for me. But it's good, I think, with, you know, the fall season happening and you giving this talk and sort of leading up to the retreat. You know, winter, and these times are times to go inward and develop. You know.
Yeah.
So looking forward to getting to the retreat. And
me too.
Getting into the book a little more, picking up the second half. So, thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. That's funny that Kevin, is it?
Yes.
That you mentioned about the season, because I was outside today with my dog, and I had the same thought about how in my life right now, there's been a lot of transformation going on, in large part because of finding this Sangha, and just like a whole renewed, like a real, you know, shot of focus. And the thought outside of the cold breeze and the leaves all falling, and how winter is going to be like a great time to really, you know, sit, and the quiet of, you know, when there's snow on the ground, the peacefulness of winter.
Yeah.
For me, at least, I know everyone takes the seasons differently, but I find winter to be a great time to, you know, really keep your energy in, kind of, and really focus on something. And I have a few things to really put my energies into, and I'm really, yeah, really looking forward to, season change.
Okay. Thank you. You're right. You know, this is the winter time is a good time to just to take it as it comes and be a little quieter and go within. The original Sangha, they lived in an area of northern India where they had the monsoons, and that was their, they called it the rains retreat, but it was really just 3 months where it was impractical to try to walk around northern India, so they just stayed in one place and got quiet and developed the Dhamma that way. The first retreat. Tim, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you, John. Good to see you. Practice is going well. Consistently, my meditation is going well. I've been reading multiple books. Yours is one of them. I picked up another book on Buddha's words on the Pali Canon. I wanted to talk to you afterwards about a couple technical things.
Sure.
If I could. Saturday's Dhamma was very confusing for me. And this ties into what we talked about today. You know, the karma thing is I'm having a hard time grasping. I think I'm getting to that level now where when I'm reading the suttas, they're hard to interpret because of the way they're written. Because Buddha never wrote anything.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of repetition because it was orally transmitted.
Yeah.
Okay. So reading introductions, you know, people have different takes on those things. And karma is all over the place for me.
Yeah.
I know what you just said makes a lot of sense. But then when I read some suttas from Buddha's words, they contradict some of those things in my mind. This particular sutta I've read many times, and I really like it because it really ties into human nature, what we really could be and want to be. Human nature wants to help. Human nature wants to be compassionate. Human nature wants to love. We want to do those things, and all the self-referential things that happen and conditions that happen when I look at my life prevent us from doing that sometimes. So this sutta is a reminder to be that way. And it's a very natural thing to have. If you look at things that have just happened with the hurricanes, you see people helping, being very selfless and helping people who are in need. So when that was described, you're right, it's only that one time. So, you know, it just goes to show you that it only has to be said once, because it happens all the time, all over the world, every day.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot. Thank you for listening. So I'm gathering all this information, and I'm at that point where I'm just, you know, taking my time with it and
that's the key.
Getting to conclusions. So.
Take your time with it. There's a lot, especially if you're reading the other. You're reading the suttas. Part of the problem, depending on the book you're reading, but the Sutta Pitaka, the second book of the Pali Canon, which are the recordings of the Buddha's direct teachings and a few other people during the time, were originally written in. What's the right word? A dialect of the Pali, ancient Pali language, not exactly Pali. And so the translations are from either that, someone who actually knows Pali, or they're from either the Chinese translations or often German translations. So you can see that there's quite a few steps. And even if it's directly from the Pali is not a language that can be word for word translated into English. Most of those types of languages, and I can't think of the technical word for that type of language versus the Romance languages. So every translation, if they're scholarly translations, and most of the good ones out, most of anything that you're going to come across is written by someone who knows what they're doing. Bhikkhu Bodhi, Thanissara Bukka, you go down the list. They're interpreting and translating the sutta in isolation. What I mean by that is, in order to translate correctly, they have to just be focused on the sutta they're trying to translate. It's the only possible way of doing it. what that means is, though, that they're presenting that one sutta that you read. One of the things that came up recently for me from an online sutta is the Anapanasati Sutta that I mentioned earlier. And there's lines in there that can be wildly misinterpreted. And this student got back to me, what happened? You know, this doesn't mean, it's all confusing. It's taken out of context. And if you take one sutta out of context, it's impossible to understand how it applies and how it fits together. You have to understand what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, what his very first teaching was, the Four Noble Truths, and that everything he taught from that point forward was in the context of Four Noble Truths to develop an understanding of dependent origination. And when you look at it that way, then things start making sense. But even something like you must have read something about karma that didn't fit in with what I've been teaching the last couple of weeks. The reason why is that the translator was taking that sutta out of context. The difference between what that translator was doing and what is in my article and what I've been teaching the last 5 weeks is I'm teaching it within the broader context, so it fits in that way. And if just to finish this, if you remember one thing about karma is that karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. That probably doesn't have a lot of meaning to any of you, but what it means is if our minds are well concentrated through Shamatha Vipassana meditation and we're developing the framework of the Eightfold Path, then we can take the momentum of past actions, and instead of having those determine our future experience, we can use them to start inclining our mind towards awakening. A shorter way of saying that is we stop acting from a conditioned point of view. Stop recreating the same conditions, which is really, karma is like this big kind of cosmic groundhog day where we're just stuck in experiencing life from ongoing wrong views. It doesn't mean that every situation is the same, like it was in the movie, but we experience life in a similar way. So you need to be, I'll talk to you afterwards, but again, if anybody of you are reading the sutta, you'll find one thing is that they're incredibly repetitive and they're very, very difficult to make sense of, mostly because of that. But remember, the reason why they're repetitive is it was first an oral tradition. And this was the beginning of Buddhist chant, not for magical or mystical reasons. The Buddhist chant first started as a very skillful way of maintaining the Buddhist teachings. They chanted them. They repeated the same teachings over and over again. There's a section in the new book about how that came to be. But it was just a skillful means of maintaining the Dhamma, this constant repetition. So groups of monks and nuns would get together, and their charge was to remember certain suttas. And the way they would remember it and teach it was to simply to repeat it over and over again to whoever they were teaching and to each other. They would get together and they'd repeat the same thing over and over again, and they would check each other. Is that right? Do I still remember this and present it correctly? And that preserved the Buddhist teachings for a number of years until it was first written down. But it was written down then in the same way that they remembered it, in this repetitive way. Thanks for bringing that up. There's an important point. Sorry I got off track a little bit. Isabel, good to see you tonight.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you for asking. Isabel's the only one that ever asked.
I think that with what you just said about karma, I have a question.
Sure.
So is the idea of karma that if we're aware of our suffering, I'm trying to think of how to word this, because I'm still trying to grasp the idea, too, out of my conditioned mind of what I've been told karma is. You know? So I think that's where I get confused, not confused, but where I'm like relearning conditioning that, or that way, or like removing that way that just kind of makes it,
I know.
And because I do come from a background of like esoteric mystical beliefs, and so for me there's so much that, not that I've identified with them in the sense of that's like the only thing I ever believe, but that's where when learning about these different, whether it's a different religion or spirituality, like I like to learn, I like to be knowledgeable on all these things,
obviously.
But this is something, this Sangha and this, and you know, the Dhamma, like this is something that's become more honestly, the only thing I've ever really stuck with where I've, like, actually, it's a practice, and it's something that I'm developing. So when it, with the idea of karma, is it that we are using our path, the knowledge of our suffering from, like, the past, of living and suffering in the past, to help us to stay in this, to help us to follow the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Is that somewhat?
that's a skillful way of looking at your karma unfolding, rather than something that's a burden or imposed on you, or that you might be fortunate to have. People, you know, good karma, bad karma, because it is a completely impersonal experience. But to look at it that way, that it's a way of looking at the disappointing and possibly suffering nature of human life as karma unfolding is a skillful way to look at it. So, ultimately, we recognize that karma is more the way we're thinking about the events of our life rather than the events of our life, because that's a more accurate description of karma. If you want to know what your karma is, look in the mirror, you know, because it's what's occurring in your life right now, and how you're reacting to it or responding to it.
You mentioned something earlier about karma being a rebirth of an ignorant or ignorance in the way of thinking.
Yes. So, of course. So, this class is getting into the class of karma. No, but it's important. Well, I'm the one who first brought it up, so it's totally appropriate. I will say that this is, Saturday will be our sixth class on karma, so I'm not likely to, and we're going to be one or two more based on this one article. Karma is, and this is, you referred to this, the conditioned way of looking at karma is that it's something that is being imposed on us from our past actions, or it's part of some grand spiritual system of balancing the scales. Or at the very least, it's a form of behavior modification by making us experience our own behavior. And it's none of those things. The Buddha taught karma, much like, well, exactly how I'm teaching it today, to refute the common uses of the word back then, which were very common to what I just expressed, that it's not. Karma's always been part of that wrong view. And the Buddha only used the term. In fact, there's some Buddhist scholars will say the Buddha really didn't teach karma for any other reason except because other people were talking about that. That's not true. Understanding karma is understanding, and in fact, he says that in a few of the suttas, that understanding karma is understanding the Four Noble Truths. And the words are that karma should be understood, which is the same word he uses for dukkha. Dukkha, suffering, should be understood. The cause of karma, meaning the cause of dukkha, should be understood. The cessation of karma should be experienced, and the path, which relates to the Third Noble Truth. And then he says karma, the path leading to the cessation of karma should be developed, which is exactly what he says about the Fourth Noble Truth. The path leading to the cessation of dukkha should be understood. So dukkha and karma are essentially the same thing from a different point of view. Getting back to my description of karma, and this relates to what you just brought up, David. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, one of the most misapplied and misunderstood teachings, which is unfortunate because if you misunderstood and misapplied dependent origination, anything that follows can only continue what the Buddha awakened to, which is ignorance. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states from ignorance, very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths, through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises. So the important point there is not to get lost in the weeds of the 12 links, although they're important to look at, and they're up on the board, and I teach about them often. It is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that cause all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. So the Buddha's very first teaching wasn't to teach dependent origination. In fact, it's hard to determine even when he first taught it, but the Paticca-samuppada Sutta was probably taught, my guess, is at least 3 months and maybe 3 to 4 years into his teaching career. But again, there's no way to qualify that. The reason why he didn't teach it initially is because there was no context at all to understand it to the people that he was teaching. It would be ridiculous. And I never teach it out of context. I always teach... That's not true. I do teach just the sutta once in a while, but only with a group that has the context. So the Buddha's very first teaching was the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is that dukkha occurs. The Buddha's description of dukkha is birth is suffering, dukkha. Sickness is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering, is dukkha. Getting what is undesired, what is not wanted, is suffering. And there sometimes will be other descriptions of suffering. And then he would conclude that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. Now again, another unfamiliar phrase. The five clinging aggregates are simply the description of the personal experience of suffering. So what he's saying, in short, all of that describes the personal experience of suffering. I know I've probably gotten away from your question, David. But
no, actually, that's helpful. So is dukkha suffering?
Dukkha means all manner of suffering.
All manner of suffering. Okay.
From minor disappointment to the general unsatisfactoriness of life.
That's the nature of karma.
It's experienced as karma.
Okay.
So, and the reason why I made that fine distinction is karma is not suffering imposed on us. Karma is the experience of life rooted in wrong views that cells that are rooted in ignorance.
Okay.
That, and thank you for dragging it out of me, or drawing it out of me. Because what that points
it's
to...
It's the experiential end of dukkha.
It's the experiential end of dukkha.
Okay.
So the way to end it is the same way that we end the
Four Noble Truths.
The way to end it is through the Four Noble Truths, ending ignorance of Four Noble Truths. When we end ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we're no longer living life from those wrong views. We're seeing things clearly as they occur. We're mindful of our life as it unfolds moment by moment without any self-referential views. So then there's no opportunity to continue karma, continue that suffering. And that leads to rebirth. So because we've now recognized and abandoned all wrong views rooted in ignorance, there's no possibility, there's no momentum or possibility to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. We are now living a human life, however long we have, in a mind that is rested and rooted in peace and equanimity, free of karma. And that's the important, again, this, now I'm teaching my Saturday class on Thursday night, but that's the important point about rebirth too. The Buddha never said there's no such thing as future births, but he completely discounted the common belief of reincarnation of an individual soul. And what's useful to remember, if we don't want to give birth to another lifetime rooted in ignorance, we'll wake up in this lifetime and not give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, because the next moment rooted in ignorance is essentially the same thing as having another life rooted in ignorance. There's just a longer period of time between this moment and the next moment and this life and the next life. That's the only thing that we really should be concerned about. Those great questions about, well, what happens to me after I die? Is it the same person born again? You know, getting into the grander questions of is the universe finite or infinite, et cetera, et cetera. When the Buddha was asked that question, he would answer it in two ways. One way, and it was a typical way, was that's his answer. And he's implying, he's not being rude, he's saying that the answer itself, if he gave an answer, it would just lead to more confusion, and the answer itself is rooted in ignorance. Ignorance of what? Four Noble Truths. And then oftentimes he would respond by saying, it's the question yourself that's causing you confusion. Let go of the question. Sometimes he would say that it's an invalid question, meaning it doesn't relate to the developing the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It's just a distraction. So again, bringing it all back to what's most important is what's occurring right now. What's the quality of my mind in this present moment? If it's agitated and seeking further distraction, what's going to follow? More agitation and more distraction. If it's well-framed, if I've taken refuge in the truth that a human being developed this understanding and awakened, left us his teaching, and that we're fortunate enough to have a well-focused sangha, then I can develop this teaching in this lifetime and awaken. So thank you, Tim, for leading this into something that was really, I think, important. So, and for the other questions and comments. Now, where did I end up? With Isabel? Were you finished, Isabel?
Yeah, that was just great. I just...
when it makes sense,
I'm not
huh?
trying to like cling on to it in that sense, but I really do love when it all just makes sense and then it's simple. Like, as I don't know, just even the way that you describe how Buddha would answer the questions, like that's great.
It really it's
and like, and yes, you know, like I can probably see a lot, like some people really like maybe butting heads and think that way, but if you are trying to develop, you know, the Eightfold Path and like under the Four Noble Truths, like with that answer, like there's peace in that. And that's really just made me feel really good.
Thank you for saying that. I so appreciate your enthusiasm. Because it gives us all that enthusiasm. Enthos means in spirit and inspires all of us, and we should have enthusiasm for this. And when we recognize it, it brings comfort, doesn't it? And it does seem like it's almost obvious when you get it. And the reason why that is because it's now penetrating that conditioned thinking. It's getting past that veil of ignorance, and it doesn't take a lot, but it does take a certain amount of determination and a certain amount of enthusiasm for what's present. To me, and I think you're really seeing it tonight, the most remarkable thing is that these teachings are still available. And as I talk about this more on retreat, and if Kevin would remember this, and Kevin would remember this from the last retreat, what our retreats are like, and maybe you would disagree with, I don't know, I should ask you, and you can comment on this. What our retreats are like are very, very similar, if you could have something like that 2,600 years later, as the very first Sangha. And the reason why is because we are so well focused only on what the Buddha taught. We're having these same experiences that those people had in that first Sangha. Would you agree with that? You don't have to make me feel good by saying yes, but...
I agree. Yeah.
Yes. And isn't that remarkable that we're able to do that? And it's not because I'm such a remarkable teacher. It really isn't. What is most remarkable, and this is how I truly feel about it, what is most remarkable about the Buddha's Dhamma, this thing that this awakened man gave 2,600 years ago, and I don't see myself in any special way. What is most remarkable about this is that I have a mind that can understand it. I was able to grasp it. And believe me, there is nothing special about the way that I think or view the world. And that leads back to that first refuge of the Buddha. Because I can understand it, I know that other people can. If I didn't know that, I wouldn't know that everybody else can. And it doesn't take anything extraordinary. It just takes practice. It's right there. Again, the most remarkable thing in my lifetime is to come across the suttas and then to eventually make sense with it, because it was difficult at first. And it wasn't until my aha moment was reading the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta, setting the wheel of truth in motion, the Four Noble Truths. Reading it and finally realizing everything the Buddhists taught, everything I've been trying to read and make sense of, was taught in this context. And then all the other things, dependent origination and the clinging, all that, then it made sense because it was now in the proper context for me to see it. And that's the problem with reading, this is what might come up later, that's the problem with just reading the suttas, because they're not written in a way that you can apply them directly. The main impetus between the new book, Becoming Buddha, is to present, I think it's 23 suttas, in a way that they form the right context. But that's not often how they're taught. So, thank you, Isabel. Nash, good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I kind of want to go back to a karma thing.
Please.
For a second. So when you were talking about it, as we kind of discussed it, as this kind of momentum influencing our, like, the way that we're thinking, I was, like, what I was thinking about it was, that, I don't know if it's, like, it's just kind of this attitude that a thinking I sort of adopted, and that, it is what it is, and that's mainly came from this, like, it's something that I don't have any control over.
Meaning you're thinking?
Like this idea of karma, like I don't have any control over, like, I don't know, it just, another way to put it is that it doesn't serve me, and it doesn't, I don't know, it's, just thinking about it kind of, it confused me, so I sort of thought to myself, why am I thinking about this?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I almost feel like I don't understand it, and I don't do I need to understand it to escape it?
Or? No, it's a really, I don't mean to interrupt you. It's a good point, because if something, it's a self-referential ego self that will grab onto something that it doesn't understand and insist on understanding it in that moment. I need to get this. I should. If it's confusing, and actually I would say if it's causing a lot of stress or even a little bit of stress, let it go. Put it aside for now. Because it will, especially if you keep coming here, but as long as you continue to be engaged in the Dhamma, it will come up. Mm-hmm. And you'll see it in a different light maybe a week from now or a year from now. But what I'm teaching you about karma is completely different than when I first came across it, you know, because I believed it was those things that I said it's not. So it's fine. If you find it confusing right now, just put it aside. Continue with your Dhamma practice, and at some point, it will become clear. That being said, karma has more to do with your thinking rather than what events are unfolding in your life. The momentum of those events is driven by your conditioned thinking, what you're holding in mind. I'll give you a good example. Sometimes this is helpful, sometimes it's not. It's a little bit silly. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I ate a huge bowl of blueberries. I mean, gigantic, because I just loved them at the time. And I became really sick. It was well into my adulthood before I ever ate another blueberry. I didn't ever think about the possibility of not having a big bowl. I was just sick from eating blueberries. So I had conditioned my mind that blueberries make me sick. And it was really an accident that I ate one again and didn't die from it, so now I love blueberries. But that's an example of conditioned thinking. And an example of karma would be a bowl of blueberries getting pushed in front of my face and me reacting to it. It's completely irrational, isn't it? But you can understand the conditioned thinking that drove my irrational response. The reaction was my karma. It wasn't seeing blueberries again. But the wrong view of karma would be saying, oh, the poor soul, he had to experience blueberries. That's punishment for something or an unfortunate experience. The blueberries in me are completely detached. There's nothing, there's no relation there. The karma was my reaction to it. It's going to make me sick. Is that clear?
Very.
So it's kind of a silly example, but it's what occurs with all of the things that happen in our lives that we react to. They're all rooted in some type of conditioned thinking, in hating blueberries, or whatever else it might be. Now you can see that once my mind, and it wasn't because of the Dhamma that my mind cleared of hating blueberries. It was a direct experience. But you can see that once you change your point of view, change your thinking, your experience of what's unfolding in your life changes completely, doesn't it? Because you're seeing it differently. The way to see that through the Eightfold Path is you've now gone from wrong view of you rooted in ignorance to a right view of you rooted in reality. You're seeing things clearly. You're seeing them without any self-referential view, so there's no reaction. There's no eye-making in there. So again, if that's leaving you a little bit more confused, I hope not.
No.
But it will develop. You'll see this much more clearly. The recordings are on the website on one page, and they're in one player too. In other words, they're in order. So if you really want to get into, if you got 8 hours to kill, you can listen to the talk. So in the article. Any other questions about that? Did I help you bring some clarity? I hope.
Yeah. I think I'm gonna have to shelf it for now. It's just,
me,
I don't
too.
Know. The way I'm thinking about it is I don't know. I don't have any control. I'm trying not to think of karma as this like driving force for, you know, the scales evening out, but
it's not that.
Right. And even if it was, like, I can't do anything about that. And I don't know. I don't know. Never mind. I'm going to shelf it.
Yeah, I think you should, but I'm going to make one more comment. It's not... When I say that karma has its own momentum, the momentum is gained from our thinking, not from some outside force or agency pushing karma on us. Karma is occurring only in our minds. It's not occurring in the world, even though it seems like it.
So is karma created by our conditioned thinking?
Yes. Conditioned thinking, and another way of looking at conditioned thinking is it's thinking that has arisen or has its roots or foundation in ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
So is karma, in this context, is it us trying to give meaning to things that don't need meaning?
Yeah, that's another way. The way I would phrase that is taking things personally that are completely impersonal.
Okay,
so another way, and this might be helpful, ultimately karma is like foam on the ocean. There's really nothing there. It's only our thinking and our reaction to what's unfolding in our life that makes it seem like something that we don't want. Or another, you know, there's people who talk about good karma. All karma is a distraction. We want to get rid of all karma. But there's people that talk about good karma. You win the lottery. Well, there's some good karma. You know? And the same thing is true about, you have a couple of bad days, well, you got bad karma. That's not an application of karma. Neither one of those things are true.
It's like a misapplication of language. Mm-hmm. That's good fortune and misfortune, or
yeah.
Life as life occurs, and you want it to be different, right?
Yeah, it's all I'm making.
We're talking from the moment of that we have unfolding at this moment, whether it's rooted in ignorance or rooted or engaged towards mindfulness. That's what will follow. You know, we're
yeah.
going to have moments
yeah.
that are ignorant, and if you want to tie them all together and say that's your karma, that's okay too, but it's not really, but it's just more ignorant stuff happening and you experiencing it through the wrong view of ignorance. But if you're climbing the mind towards awakening and things are happening to you, a guy cuts you off in the car, or you get a parking ticket, and a whole string of stuff happens, but you're still maintaining the samadhi, the awakening, awakened mind state, you're extinguishing anything that could be called karma or
yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah, that's right. Another, that's an important, it is just a word too, that has, it's a word that has often power behind it, but it really doesn't. It's just a word. It just describes something in it.
So, for instance, how do you handle karma when you're attached? I'm still reprogramming my mind. I come from a very emotional family, and I'm Hispanic, so by nature I am very emotional. And what happened in Puerto Rico is very close to my heart because
oh, yeah.
I have a lot of family and friends, and I know that there are people in my family that need dialysis and medication, and they're not getting it, and they're going to die. So how do I manage that? With what
oh.
you're teaching.
First thing I would say is you don't manage it. You know, I would say you can't manage it, and you shouldn't try to manage it. And this really has nothing to do with karma either. But I will mention that. What occurred in Puerto Rico, what has occurred with all these natural disasters, what occurred when that person stepped off the curb and got hit by a car, I'm just speaking in a metaphorical, is all part of the First Noble Truth. Dukkha occurs. As a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be suffering. Things like what happened in Puerto Rico are going to occur. That doesn't mean that we should dismiss it, but what it does allow us to do is to understand it as simply a natural consequence of living in the world, even though it's horrible. But there's no other meaning to it. In other words, it's not... I didn't hear this about what happened in Puerto Rico, but I did hear it recently relating karma to those... It was when the tsunami hit Japan. And for some reason, people said... And more than one person said it, and I heard it, that, well, that's their karma unfolding. That's such an awful, hurtful thing to say. For one thing, it's just wrong. But how can you make the correlation between all those people? And you can't. That's a wrong application of karma. So what happened in Puerto Rico, all these other things that happened, have nothing to do with karma. It just doesn't. But they're awful. They're disasters. And so what's the most important thing you can do? This sutta points to it. The first thing you can do is whatever you can to address the physical needs of the people there, whatever it is. And this is overwhelming, isn't it? You know, most of us can't go to Puerto Rico tonight and help, even though I bet everyone in this room that if we could, we would. We can't. So then the next thing you can do, if you have people that you love, you when you can, you get in contact with them, you do everything you can. You let them know that you care about them. If you can, if you're in a position where you can send them $10, you send them $10. You do whatever you can. But you do it from a mind of understanding without getting yourself more agitated. That being said, it's entirely appropriate to feel concerned and sad and all the other things that follow from that. What the Dhamma teaches us is to not insist that I feel any different than I'm feeling. We feel what's appropriate when it's appropriate to feel. It kind of relates to the Vitakasanthana Sutta. We think what we want to think when we want to think it. It's appropriate to be to feel how you feel. It's unskillful to think you should feel any other, and I'm not saying you're doing this, that you should feel any other difference. But there's small comfort in that, isn't there? Another aspect of what the Buddha is teaching is it's a radical look at reality, meaning at some time, sometimes in life, there's just pain. There's just suffering. And sometimes it's because we care so much about other people or because we're familiar with other people or our family members. We're not supposed to feel anything other than concern and compassion. And if we have the ability to act, to go amongst the town folk and clean them up, we do it. And then at that point, we're an expression of our understanding of the Dhamma. That doesn't mean that you start teaching the Dhamma when people aren't ready to hear it. But if they're ready, you can do that too. So does that answer your question, I hope?
Yeah.
Thank you for asking. It really is an important question, and it comes up a lot because often when you don't have a complete understanding of what the Buddha is teaching, it sounds like you're just rejecting the whole world and you don't care anything about other people's suffering when it's really just the opposite. By gaining a true understanding of your own suffering and your own dukkha, you gain a profound understanding of others and you can develop true compassion and true empathy. Thank you for bringing it up. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Practice has been consistent. I don't do go with the cold. So it's hard to focus on your breathing.
Yeah.
It's hard to breathe. This space and this teaching and this Buddha have really been a refuge. Mm-hmm. Something that I think I have been seeking for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Just in this past year, I was able to find it or discover it, or it came to me. So it really has been a refuge. And just coming to this Sangha, it's so comforting and so, well, it's so intense. It's so important.
Thank you. It is. It is a real comfort, isn't it? I mean, it may not seem so when I'm sitting in this seat, but I take a lot of comfort from this Sangha and what's developed here. So thank you all. Annette, good to see you tonight.
I'm still learning. Yeah. And
me too.
It's challenging for me, but I'm learning. I'm so happy that I came here because usually when my husband and I come here, we sleep really good. That night, we're refreshed. Like, we need to go back to meditation.
Yeah. Isn't it? That's worth the price of admission. A good night's sleep.
And yes, and we're able to rest and I guess feel at peace. Yeah. So something is working, yeah. And I'm very happy to be here and to learn again. It's reprogramming my mind.
Yeah.
To the different thinking and the teachings of Buddha.
Yeah.
So I. Thank you very much for doing this and for teaching us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for being a part of it. You really see that correctly in that you're really adjusting the way you think. That's the common problem. That's what conditioned thinking means. That's thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's what the Buddha realized upon his awakening. After his awakening, he sat off and on again in meditation for 2 more weeks, considering, is there a way to teach what he now understood in a way that would get past that common human problem of conditioned thinking. How can I change people's views from wrong views to right views? Excuse me. Another way of saying those views are settled in a deluded mind. So how do you show a deluded mind that it's deluded? A deluded mind is deluded. How would it know? It needs a framework. And that's why I keep saying it's not just meditation. The framework for recognizing and abandoning ignorant views is the Eightfold Path. It takes the entire path. And you're just beginning that, and you're grasping it very well already. So I'm glad you're here tonight. David, good to see you tonight.
I'm not sure how to express how I'm feeling about this, but I've learned a lot tonight, and it just seems real familiar.
Yeah. That's a great word. When something's really rings true, you kind of know it. You know, you might question how come I didn't see it before, but you just know it. So. Well, did I cut you off? I'm sorry.
No, I'm just trying to think of how to describe what I'm thinking. I'm falling short.
Sometimes you just can't describe it.
You know? I know that there's, and Greg, I kind of share the same sentiment. I've noticed that the fall kind of brings me back to me.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a thinking time of the year for me. And it's kind of coinciding with this, which is good.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel the same way about winter and the colder months. I always liked them. It seemed to be just instilling a natural peace.
Yeah, you know. It's like summer is kind of the doing time.
Yeah.
Fall, where's the
thinking
time? Spring's getting ready time.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, any other questions about the Ratana Sutta or Karma?
You don't want to ask that. It's our questions that are causing us confusion.
Pardon me?
I understand karma a little better.
Good. It when you finally get it, it really isn't all that difficult, but. Okay, a few quick announcements. I know I kept telling myself three, so I wouldn't forget. One is our retreat begins three weeks from tonight, I believe. And there's just a couple of rooms left. So if you're going to go, now's the time to sign up. The guided meditations on becoming-buddha.com are now all on one page and in one player. And there's a 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, and 45 minute meditations on there. So pick your length. The reason why is that a young person met with me last Saturday, and anyway, I decided it'd be a good thing to just have some graduated meditations on there. They're all on under guided meditations. The retreat. Donna Dinner. The Donna Dinner is on. It's going to be the Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. November 21st, this is, I think it's our 7th or 8th, it's just those that haven't been or even know about the Donna Dinner, it's at Love and Oven. It's a free open dinner for the entire community, not just our Sangha, but our Sangha along with Matt and Love and Oven host it. It's really just a remarkable event, and I won't get into some of the stories, but there's some really remarkable stories about people that were so lifted up by the dinner. People that are in our own community and isolated because of their situation. So again, it's open to everyone, all your family, friends. You don't have to be a meditator. The idea, Love and Oven will cook the traditional dinner, turkey and salad and dessert. And then those of us that can, we bring a dish to share. So it's a potluck that way. And possibly a practical gift for those in the community. So those things meaning it might be blankets or kids' mittens and that kind of thing. I'll get a list on the website. Also, we're taking on, as our Donna Project, an alternative high school in Flemington, it's run by one of our Sangha members, Mary Beth. It's called the Rare... I can't think of the name of it right now. But there will be info on the website about that. And so Donna means generosity. So that's the name of the dinner. It's also the name of our project. So the idea is that we're going to support this alternative high school in any way that we can. And one of the ways that we can is to, the way the school works is that they teach the kids what they want to learn rather than a forced curriculum. And so the kids might decide that they want to learn landscaping, and one of us is a landscaper, so we'll go. She'll go and teach them that. Somebody might want to learn something about mindfulness, and maybe I'll go. Someone might want to learn about finance, and Kevin might go. So we all have our unique gifts. What we're going to do is to describe, those that want to get involved, and everybody has to do it, describe what we might have to offer in a paragraph or two, and we're going to put it in a book that they're going to have reference to. And a kid wants to learn something, they'll have, well, here's some teachers, and we'll go in and give them some of our time. Might be an hour or two, or might be a little bit longer. And also practical things. If they need a room painted, we might make it a project of our sangha to go do that. So I think that's the announcements tonight.
Learning cooperative, I think it was.
The Raritan Learning Cooperative, yeah. It's really remarkable. This is the third one in the area. There's a Princeton and a Bucks County Learning Cooperative. But the idea is for people, and I know this, I mean, I wish it was around when I was in high school, because I love the idea of learning, but I just couldn't handle the structure of, I just couldn't do it. I wasn't one of those people. And so they already had, they just opened, they already have five kids that are willing to learn in that environment. You know, I think that's remarkable. And they will, you know, they're going to, however they do it, they'll be prepared to go to college if they want to afterwards. It's not like they're going to be lost because of the situation. And I think they're going to learn, they'll learn what they want to learn, and they'll learn some good things. You know, they're already doing some really wonderful things with technology and stuff that they're teaching the kids. So anyway, so that's going to be our Donna project. There'll be more info on the website. I'll put a page up, and we'll get more involved with them as time goes on. So. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Great. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. Metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a remarkable class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.